This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have as my guest, Tad Daly. Tad Daly is the author of Apocalypse Never, Forging the Path to a Nuclear-Free World. Tad Daly, welcome to Progressive Radio.
I am delighted to be here, Matt Rothschild. Let me just say that I know something about Madison, Wisconsin, and something about the Progressive Magazine, and it's a real privilege for me, a citizen of the left, to be on the air with you.
Well, it's nice of you to say, and the issue that you've been wrestling with all these years and that you've devoted yourself to getting into in great detail in this book has been a crucial issue. Issue number one, as my predecessor Irwin Knoll at the Progressive Magazine used to call the issue of nuclear weapons, Topic A. Wondering how you got into Topic A. I read in this book that your father was a navigator in U.S. bombing planes over Japan at the end of World War II. Non-nuclear planes, bombing planes, I should add.
Yes. Same aircraft, though, for what it's worth, a B-29 Super
really?
Fortress.
Huh.
Exact same plane as dropped as the Enola Gay. Yeah.
How did his experience influence your political views or your views on this subject?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Matt. Thank you. The book, neither the book nor my work is really about the question of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and that enduring question that people like you and I and many others have talked about whether that was the right thing or the wrong thing to do. But that said, my father, like so many people of his generation, used to say, well, it's too darn bad that we had to do that, but it clearly saved my life. As you shared, yes, he was a navigator and a bombardier on B-29 Super Fortresses, actually flew in the very last bombing mission of the Second World War on August 15th. The Japanese surrendered while they were still in the air.
He hurt his back doing so, too.
That's right, yeah, and had back pain the rest of his life. But he and there was kind of a conventional wisdom emerged in the years after the end of the Second World War, which was there were only two choices facing the United States in August of 1945. One was to launch the nuclear age by obliterating Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the other was to launch a massive land invasion of the Japanese home islands. My father would have continued to fly 50 more missions and may well, as he said, have been killed in such an undertaking. But the more I began to study it, the more I realized that, A, there certainly were some other alternatives facing the United States in August of 1945. And I guess, B, Matt, I think there certainly were some other ways that the history of the nuclear age might have unfolded. I don't think that it was a determined outcome that we had to have this huge arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union that you remember the phrases, we could destroy the world 77 times over. Now we can destroy the world 177 times over. And I certainly don't think that the only alternative now is to keep these things around forever until the end of time. I think there are definitely other better ways for maintaining our national security and maintaining peace on Earth.
Yeah, I certainly want to get into those. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Listening to Progressive Radio right now, I'm speaking with Tad Daly, who is the author of a book called Apocalypse Never, Forging the Path to a Nuclear-Free World. Before you ventured into this book, you worked with two people I had great respect for. One is former Senator Alan Cranston of California. Tell me what he was like.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Alan Cranston was a great mentor and role model and friend to me. Just to remind your listeners, he represented California in the U.S. Senate for four terms, 24 years from 1969 until 1993. And when he left the Senate in January of 1993, he said, there is one issue that I worked on during my time in the Senate that absolutely transcends all other issues, and that is the nuclear issue. Alan used to say, if a single atom bomb goes off a single time in a single city of the world, all other issues will become trivial by comparison. And Matt, he pretty much devoted his entire life from January of 93 until December 31st, 2000, which is when he passed away, the last day of the 20th century, exclusively to the issue of nuclear weapons abolition. And I pretty much was his chief sidekick and research director and grassroots organizer and brainstorm partner for about the last 3.5 years of that period. And I guess another thing, this is a bit of a segue, but it's an important one, I think. Many of our listeners may know that nuclear weapons abolition has gotten some high-profile establishment attention in recent years. I think the thing that is most notable are these twin op-eds in the Wall Street Journal. I know you're aware of them, by Kissinger, Nunn, William Perry, and George Shultz, who these four lions of the foreign policy establishment who came out for nuclear weapons abolition. That is a real step in the right direction as far as I'm concerned. But I guess I'd like to say Alan Cranston, four-term U.S. senator from the largest state in the country, is certainly of a comparable stature to any of them. And he was talking about it a good decade and a half before any of them were.
Well, I would say not only a comparable stature, but probably a much better stature, certainly, than some of those people. Most notorious of all, Henry Kissinger. So I would put Cranston way ahead of Henry Kissinger in any hierarchy of morals.
Establishment stature and stature as a good progressive, yeah, like you and me.
There have also been a lot of military people who have come out, former heads of the not only the Defense Department like William Perry, but of the SAC, the Nuclear Weapons Air Command.
Yes.
And other military officials have come out for nuclear disarmament too. So it does have more credibility, mainstream, as you're suggesting, Tad Daly, than it used to, because people just said it was, you know, crazy pacifists that work at the Progressive were advocating such things. But it's still not common currency, and part of me wonders whether it sounds so 1982 to people that they're not interested so much in dealing with this issue right now.
Well, 1982 is an interesting year to pick, Matt. That, of course, is the year of the peak of the nuclear freeze movement. And let's just remind your listeners that, because that's one of the things I really do write about that as something that should give us hope. It's not just the case that the single largest political demonstration, apparently, in American history took place on June 12, 1982. That's the nuclear freeze demonstration in Central Park.
I was there, by the way.
You were? Yeah. Oh, excellent. I wish I had been, Matt. I wish I had been. I was a grad student in England at that time. It's not only the case that that happened, but I think, and this is some history that really isn't widely appreciated, it really had an impact. The Reagan administration, during its first few years, A, engaged in a big nuclear buildup, B, engaged in a much broader military buildup, and C, engaged in this incredibly dangerous nuclear saber rattling. Ronald Reagan had aides, policy wonks like me, who were talking about, I remember the quote, waging and winning a protracted nuclear war. The nuclear freeze movement was a direct reaction to that terrifying rhetoric and those terribly dangerous actions.
Insane rhetoric, too.
But by the end, by 1987, 1988, here's Ronald Reagan doing at least two things. One, reversing the arms race. Actually, for the first time, didn't bring us to abolition, Matt, but for the first time, enacted arms control an arms control agreement with the USSR that actually for the first time reduced overall nuclear numbers. And B, went to Geneva, met with Mikhail Gorbachev, and stood at the microphone and said, a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. And you know why he said that, Matt? Because people power made him say it, because the nuclear freeze movement made him say it. And not to go on and on here, but I guess I'd like to say we now are trying to build a movement not just for ending testing, not just for freezing an ever-accelerating arms race, but for dismantling and banning every last atom bomb on planet Earth.
I'm speaking with Tad Daly. He's the author of a really important book called Apocalypse Never, Forging the Path to a Nuclear-Free World. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine. So let's get to the heart of the book here and the heart of the arguments. You say, essentially, that the catastrophe of nuclear war is inevitable unless we abolish these weapons. Why is it inevitable?
I think it's only a matter of time, Matt. I wouldn't quite say nuclear war. I'd say some kind of nuclear catastrophe. For example, one of the chapters is about nuclear terror. We wouldn't call that a nuclear war, but it would be a cataclysm of unprecedented magnitude if tomorrow morning St. Louis or Phoenix or Atlanta disappeared in a radioactive cloud. But I think the danger of that is very real. And I also talk in the book about scenarios like the possibility of launching not just one nuclear weapon, like in the nuclear terror scenario, but 101 nuclear weapons by computer malfunction. Wait till people read that chapter and you'll see just how close we've come in the past 66 years of the nuclear age. And then there's the possibility of nuclear crisis mismanagement on at least two occasions during the Cold War, Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, which many people know about, the Abel Archer Crisis in 1983, which very few people know about. We came this close to a full-scale nuclear war, totally by misunderstanding the intentions of the other side. And if we keep these things around for decades and decades to come, one of those crises is going to go in the wrong direction.
You know, I didn't know about Abel Archer, 83, until I read this book. Why don't you tell the listener and remind me what Abel Archer was all about and how close we came.
Thanks, Matt. I didn't know about it either until I started really doing my research on this. It was completely unknown at the time. Here's the deal. It's the fall of 1983. Cold War is still raging. It's Ronald Reagan's first term. Tensions were high between the U.S. and the USSR. And so NATO conducts war games in the fall of 1983, as they did every fall. But because of the political winds of the hour, maybe because of some bad intelligence, maybe because of just being on the edge of their seats, apparently for about 72 hours, the leaders in the Politburo concluded that it wasn't war games, that we were planning to launch a full-scale conventional invasion of the East, of the Warsaw Pact, and we were going to accompany that with a nuclear first strike upon the USSR. And for 72 hours, they apparently seriously deliberated whether they should launch their nuclear weapons at us first. And the only thing that saved us was that the British happened to have a spy who was in the right place at the right time and found out that the Politburo thought that we were about to launch a nuclear first strike upon them. We weren't. But they thought we were, and he sent a frantic message back to London, said, stop the war games, stop the war games. And had that spy not been there, we might not be here right now, Matt.
I mean, that is just horrifying, these close calls. I mean, the Cuban Missile Crisis,
yes,
and the Kennedys, we know about that. This Abel Archer, 83, just learned about it, you know, today, reading this book and hearing you talk about it. Some things I had known about, accidental launches, other even more freakish accidental misreading of computers and things like that,
yes.
Satellite
yes.
pictures and things. Those have happened too, and they've happened not in the early days of the Cold War, but you know, even during
yes.
the Carter administration
yes.
and afterward. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, Matt, I guess what I'd like to say is, you know, I four chapters of the 12 in the book really recount that history and recount how many times we've come close to nuclear war by miscalculation, by nuclear – sorry, I'm hesitating because it wouldn't really be war, would it? But it could have been a complete launch of a nuclear first strike on the other side, either by the USSR on us or vice versa, completely because of computer error. But the reason I go through that history is to show that the combination of permanent human fallibility with these infinitely dangerous technologies will eventually lead to infinitely catastrophic results. And if I may share, I've been brought here to Madison, spoke in the Rainbow Bookstore last night by the Madison Physicians for Social Responsibility Group, a wonderful woman who runs it named Pam Kleiss. And I just this morning met Pam's daughter, Audrey, who is 10 years old. And you know, Matt, we all hope that Audrey and all 10-year-olds will live maybe another 90 years, right? Well, the nuclear age is only 66 years old, and we've had this many close calls. What do you think the chances are, if we continue the nuclear status quo, that Audrey, who we hope has 9 decades of good life ahead of her, will dodge all those nuclear bullets every single time?
I mean, there is one way prior to just getting rid of all the nuclear weapons that we can reduce the threat of at least these accidental nuclear incidents from happening, and that is simply to take weapons, nuclear weapons, off hair trigger alert. Have the United States and Russia, which after all hold 95% of the nuclear
yes,
weapons in
yes.
the world, take them off hair trigger alert. Hair trigger alert means there's about, you know, they're ready to launch right now, and
yes.
if if whoever...
They don't call them Minutemen for nothing. That's right. What Bruce Blair, who used to be a missileer, likes to say about this.
So, I mean, it gives the president or the head of Russia, just 15 minutes or so to decide whether, you know, the satellite image is an incoming first strike from the other side and whether to launch upon seeing that. That's an insane way to operate here, especially so many years after the Cold War is supposed to have ended. Why hasn't Obama taken weapons off hair trigger alert?
That's a real mystery. I don't really have a good answer for that. And thank you for reminding me and the listeners, Matt, that there's more to be done than just to campaign for nuclear weapons abolition. I mean, my book is very much about saying abolition must be our ultimate goal, and here are, I hope, some plausible futures by which we can bring it about. But as you remind us, there's clearly things we can do in the near term. And one of those would be, and many people, many big shots, including that Gang of Four, Kissinger, Nunn, Perry, Shultz, have advocated that, de-alerting, not keeping them on hair trigger alert, separating warheads from delivery vehicles. I don't have a good answer as to why that hasn't happened. It seems so self-evident to me. I think there's just sort of this notion that even 20 years after the end of the Cold War, the only thing that prevents someone else, be it Russia or someone else, from launching a nuclear first strike upon us is having a robust nuclear deterrent that can immediately respond. And there's just sort of this visceral feeling that it needs to be as robust as possible. But in the nuclear age, the more robust we make our nuclear capabilities, the more likely it is that other people will – two things, Matt – that other states will acquire their own nuclear weapons capabilities, and that resentments are going to breed out there at the nuclear double standard, at our claim that we can have them and others can't. And the more we develop our nuclear capabilities and deterrence, the more likely it is, I think, that somebody's going to say, I'm going to devote my life to upsetting the nuclear apple cart and finding a way to set off an atom bomb inside the United States.
And you say it's easier than people once thought for that to happen, for that kind of nuclear terror incident to occur. Why is it easier? A lot of people thought that was impossible and kind of fanciful.
You know, I don't know how to build an atom bomb, but everything I've read tells me that the hard thing is making the nuclear fuel, making highly enriched uranium or making weapons-grade plutonium. But the terrorists don't have to make it because there are thousands and thousands of tons of the stuff. Apparently, once you get your hands on it, really would be HEU. Plutonium would be probably a little too difficult for any non-state actor, I think, to build a weapon out of. But if they can get their hands on some HEU, building a crude nuclear device apparently won't be that difficult.
What is HEU?
Thank you. It's highly enriched uranium or weapons grade plutonium, I think, is the term we use for plutonium that's separated out after the end of the nuclear fuel cycle. But on this point, let me say, Matt, that you know I've slammed President Obama a couple of times already in our conversation. This is the one area in which I'm really delighted at the Obama administration. In April of 2010, he convened something they called a nuclear security summit in Washington, D.C. I think, if I have this right, I think it was the largest gathering of heads of state in Washington since Dumbarton Oaks in 1944. And it was called Nuclear Security Summit, but it was really focused exclusively on this question of securing nuclear materials. I don't think that job is completely done, but Obama's really paying some attention to it. And in the short term, it's vitally important that we do everything we can to keep HEU or small intact atom bombs out of the hands of terrorists. But in the long term, I think the only way to prevent nuclear terror and the whole other universe of nuclear dangers is the abolition of nuclear weapons.
My guest today is Tad Daly. He's the author of Apocalypse Never, Forging the Path to a Nuclear-Free World. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. One of your central arguments, Tad Daly, is that nuclear weapons are unnecessary for the United States. Why is that?
Well, thanks, Matt. Yes, that's the title of one of the chapters. Nuclear weapons are militarily useless and militarily unnecessary for us. The United States, for better or for worse, has an overwhelming conventional military superiority over any possible combination of adversaries. Now, as an aside, I don't think, and I'm quite sure that you, Matt Rothschild, don't think that necessarily is good either for American civilization or for American national security. But it clearly is the case today. It clearly will be the case for at least a couple of decades to come. And what that means is that from the perspective of deterrence, from the perspective of dissuading an enemy from launching any kind of aggression against you or your interests by being able to threaten to inflict massive damage upon them in retaliation, we are the one country in the world that can say we can do that with our conventional military power, our four capabilities alone. So that's the good news, that I think if there's any country to which we can make the case that our national security can be maintained without nuclear weapons, it's our state, the United States. The other side of that coin, though, is that that makes it more difficult for smaller, weaker states to engage in the same kind of logic. They have a massive conventional inferiority. And if I may extend the conversation a little bit, I don't think that Iran or North Korea are perfectly responsible actors on the world stage. I certainly loathe many of the things that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has said about the Holocaust and the future of Israel. But even irrational leaders can be at the head of states that have rational national interests. And Matt, if I was a defense planner in either the nation of Iran or the nation of North Korea, I would say the best way for us to maintain our national security, to prevent aggression against us by the United States, is to acquire a small nuclear deterrent. And the only way that ultimately we're going to dissuade the Irans and the North Koreas and other smaller, weaker states from either maintaining or acquiring nuclear arsenals is for us to someday diminish our overwhelming conventional military superiority and actually live in a world where somehow we govern ourselves by the rule of law rather than by the law of force.
And you say it's rational for them, not even that they need to have a weapon that can reach the United States, but it would be rational for them to have a weapon that would attack U.S. interests somewhere else in the world even.
You know, Matt, first time I've ever mentioned this in a conversation, but I wish I had it in front of me. Just about a month ago, I can't remember the name. It was an Iranian official. It wasn't Ahmadinejad, but it was some high-level Iranian official. And he said, you know, the Americans have made it easier for us to deter aggression against us by threatening. He wasn't talking about nuclear retaliation, but by being able to threaten to inflict consequences on the United States. Why? Because the United States has surrounded Iran on all four sides by American military power. Massive presence in Iran to their, I'm sorry, in Iraq to their west, massive presence in Afghanistan to their east, bases in the former Soviet Central Asian republics in the north, and what's to their south? The Persian Gulf, which is populated by the immeasurably powerful U.S. Navy. If Iran has a capability of vaporizing an American carrier group, that gives them the capability to deter aggression against us, against them, by threatening to impose unacceptable damage upon us.
While we're still on Iran, with Ahmadinejad there, or with the clerics in control, take your pick, there is some feeling that they are so irrational that they would do a first strike against Israel or do some huge attack, regardless of the fact they would face enormous annihilation, actually, as Hillary Clinton threatened during the presidential primaries. What's your feeling on that?
I guess it's possible, but it seems to me pretty unlikely. I really can't think of any episode in world history where the leaders of a state have literally committed both national suicide and personal suicide like that. The notion that the day after Iran acquired a deliverable nuclear weapon, they would lob it at Tel Aviv. I suppose it's possible. Anything is possible, but I don't think it's terribly unlikely. I don't think it's terribly likely. I think it is far more reasonable to suppose that Iran's quest, and I do believe they want to create at least the capability to acquire nuclear weapons in short order, is primarily for these defensive reasons. But that doesn't mean that I advocate Iran acquiring nuclear weapons. In fact, what I advocate is that the world community gets serious about moving toward a nuclear weapon-free world and saying to the Irans of the world, we don't want you to acquire a nuclear arsenal, and you can expect us to get serious about getting rid of our nuclear arsenal.
Which, of course, the United States and the other nuclear powers are supposed to do under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which you point out in a chapter here, a tad daily, that I thought was really, really on the mark. I want to talk about another chapter in the book, though, which deals with one of the most common arguments against nuclear disarmament, and that is that, you know, one nation is going to be cheating and is going to stash some of these nuclear weapons somewhere. And then after every other country has disarmed, they're going to say, well, voila, we've got 10 nuclear weapons and you better dance to our tune. What's wrong with that scenario?
You know, I don't want to be flip about it, Matt. I think that is a legitimate thing to worry about. First of all, yeah, it's possible that in a post, this is all hypothetical, of course, in a post-abolition world, someone might be able to either squirrel away a dozen deliverable nuclear warheads or build some in secret. I think that's very unlikely because I think the verification measures that, and as a quick aside, let me say that one of the greatest bits of evidence I think we have for that is the great success that the weapons inspectors had inside Iraq between 1991 and 2003. Iraq did have programs to develop weapons of mass destruction, but they had to open themselves up to international inspections. And consequently, what was it called? UNMOVIC and UNSCOM, I think, were the two UN commissions, prowled around the country for a dozen years and found and dismantled all the WMD programs. And consequently, after George Bush invaded in March of 2003, guess what? We didn't find any WMD at all.
And they said they couldn't find any right before he launched that war.
That's right.
And he and Cheney were saying outright lies about that to justify their war. But that's a tangent. Go on. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that's something of a historical analog to the post-abolition world that I envision and that people like me advocate, that that kind of intrusive inspection regime, that kind of intrusions on sovereignty would exist not just in the outlaw states like Iraq, but in every state of the world. Every state would have to subject itself to international inspections like that. So therefore, I think it is not impossible but unlikely that a state could hide a significant nuclear arsenal. But even if they did and somehow whipped back the curtain and said, now you have to accede to our demands or we're going to launch nuclear weapons upon you, I think they would be dissuaded by two things. One, the overwhelming conventional military power that, for better or worse, would still exist. And in fact, I quote in my book, I think it's a four-star general, Lee Butler, a former head of the Strategic Command, as you said earlier, who said they would be facing the combined conventional military might of the entire rest of the world. And then the second thing is, I mean, this may sound warm and fuzzy and soft, but it's the pariah notion. Such a state would instantly become the greatest pariah on the planet. And that's why, and I talk about this in the chapter, that's why we don't do that to Cuba, for example. We could threaten to launch a nuclear first strike on Cuba unless they acceded to our demands, and no one would retaliate against us with a nuclear arsenal. But the reason we don't is because we want to be a member of the world community. And I think the breakout scenario is a possibility, but I think the risk of that, which I have tried to argue is very low, is far exceeded, Matt, by the risk of perpetual possession, the risk of a world forever awash in nuclear weapons.
Ted Daly, we only have about 30 seconds, and here's a question that should take about 3 hours, but if you could just give me a brief answer. Politically, how can we get there?
You know, Matt, the best thing I can say is building those kinds of movements again. The limited test ban treaty came about because of a civil society movement. The nuclear freeze movement and the effects that it had on the Reagan administration happened because people power made a difference. I'm trying now to awaken the American people to say we want our leaders now with alacrity to launch formal negotiations towards a nuclear weapons elimination convention.
Well, I sure hope we get there. Ted Daly, author of Apocalypse Never, Forging the Path to a Nuclear-Free World. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Delighted to be here in the progressive center of the United States, Matt Rothschild. Thanks very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.